One ball, two strikes, two outs. 6-1, the Rangers lead in the top of the ninth. Feliz the high set. Here comes the pitch. Breaking ball, strike three, call! The Rangers are going to the World Series!
That's the voice of Eric Nadell, one of the best in the business. He has been on the call for the Texas Rangers for 40 years, and he's a Hall of Fame baseball announcer, a recipient of the Ford Frick Award. We'll talk to him, and we'll also check out Luke Maley's reflexes as we pepper him with questions about being a big league catcher.
In the 50th year of the franchise, in their 39th year in Texas, under a full moon in Arlington, the Texas Rangers have won the American League pennant. There is red, white, and blue confetti everywhere here at the ballpark. The Rangers still celebrating on the left side of the mound. Do you believe it, Ranger fans?
But we start off this week on a swing and a belt with a guy who in many ways could be viewed as important, as influential an employee as the Blue Jays have ever had. We can say this for sure. Paul Beeston was the first employee the Blue Jays have ever had. Really enjoyed my time with Paul Beeston.
Well, Paul, some of the interviews that I've done hours of research and tried to figure out everything I can, but this one I want to be more unscripted because I have a feeling you're going to lead and I'm going to follow, and I'm fine with that. My first question, I don't know how else to phrase this other than this. How the heck did an accountant from Welland become the first ever employee of the Toronto Blue Jays? What's the backstory?
Luckiest guy in the world. There's no question about that. If you drink enough beer in life, you'll get an opportunity somewhere along the way.
That should be a bumper sticker.
Well, there was no question. I mean, it was Don McDougall, who was the president of Labatt at the time, who was interested in bringing San Francisco Giants to Toronto. They actually thought they were bringing them to Toronto, and at that point, they were going to bring up the whole baseball operations from San Francisco, and they were going to put together a business operation from Toronto. I was in London. He lived beside a good friend of mine, Peter Fowler, and Don asked me whether I'd be interested in coming to Toronto. I said, are you kidding me? In baseball, this is the greatest thing in the world. And I, you know, quit my job at PricewaterhouseCoopers as it is right now, said, I'm moving. You know, I'll see you through the tax season, but at that point in time, I'm leaving. And when all that fell apart, I've now resigned my job at PricewaterhouseCoopers. I now have no leverage there. And I don't have a job here because San Francisco's not coming here. But then they got the American League team. It was re-asked, and I was fortunate enough to be able to come down here in 76.
Re-asked by the same person?
Re-asked by the same person, Don McDougall. They right. came together. McDougall got together, or Labatt got together, with Howard Webster and the CIBC. So they put a 45-45 10% group together. The National League wanted them. The American League wanted them. At the end of the day, Lee McPhail came up here, made an announcement. We are expanding into Toronto, and we're putting a team back in Seattle. And a war started at kind of the higher levels between the two leagues. Because the leagues were better back then, Dan, in all right. honesty, because they hated each other. I mean, you know, we were the junior league in the American League. You know, the National League was senior league, and they had, you know, they never fooled around with the integrity of the game. You know, we're not going to have a DH. You know, we're going to have this. We're going to have that. We're going to be better. They kind of looked down on us.
Yes.
But Lee came up here and said, here we go, boys. You know, we're coming into Toronto. And Bowie had to make a ruling and allowed it to happen.
So you're a guy in your 20s, and this is literally
31 years old. I'd like to have been my 20s. I'd have been younger
you
now.
You could have lied. Nobody would have known.
I'm not now. Exactly.
Yeah. And if you don't know Don McDougall, I mean, this is serendipitous that this happened. This just...
Not even a question about it. He was from Labatt. He knew that... You know, we used to go to baseball games in Detroit all the time, a group of us, so four of us. We'd go to four games a year, 120 miles from London, you know, and Tigers were our team, and we'd go down there and come back that night, watch the game. You know, so he needed somebody that knew something about the game or fed a feel for the game, you know, and that's when he asked me. Now, it was much more of a sport than a business is. As right now, it's a business, okay? And I think that was right in that kind of sweet spot. It was more of a sport than a business. It was morphing into a business, but, you know, it was more of a sport. Now it's quite clearly business because what have you got? I mean, you got a lot of risk there. You got long-term contracts for lots of dollars. You know, the boards of directors get together if it's a public company to determine where they're going to spend it. We send out a scout and say, boy, he's got a good live arm. Boy, you ought to see him swing. I'll tell you what, he can really do some damage. And then you hope he doesn't get hurt. So things have kind of changed. We're only 28 people. And we had arguably the worst stadium in sports. Not the worst stadium in baseball. The worst stadium in sports. Had the crown on it. The best seats were covered, you know, when the weather was bad, were the $2 bleachers.
Yep.
We had, I want to say, 17,000 chair seats, if you like, and the rest were all benches. Like, the whole thing was bizarre. But it was us, and we were playing, and we played open against Chicago, and that was it.
The Blue Jays, as we mentioned, playing a charter member of the American League back in 1901. The Chicago White Sox played the very first game in the American League. Now they're going to introduce the starting lineups. The 48th Highlanders marching on in the left field area. And we'll have some activities underway now. It looks as though they're going to give it a real try to get this ball game underway. The snow is certainly eased up considerably. It's just the white stuff on the field that's the problem. Let's see how well they do. The first man coming up is Ralph Garr, the left fielder for the White Sox, who's hit 300 or better in four of the six seasons in the major leagues. 300 average in 1976. So Bill Singer will face a tough hitter, left-hander Ralph Garr.
And one of the fastest base runners in the American League.
Here it is, the first pitch in Blue Jay history. It's a strike for the baseball. That ball has been exchanged and will go to the Canadian Sports Hall of Fame.
I grew up in that stadium, and those benches down the right field line, either you froze or you burnt your rear end on.
There's
there was no middle ground.
There's not even, and you had a good chance of being able to be some wildlife with the wildlife sanctuary.
Falling on you.
Yes.
A little goose poop. So I was one of those kids who took the bus to the subway to King, to the streetcar to the X for the Sunday doubleheaders or $2 Tuesdays or whatever it was. And you're right. If those were true. People don't know what bleachers mean anymore. Those were bleachers.
Those were bleachers.
And if you didn't get there early, you were sitting on like the 50-yard line, which was wonderful, but you were 50 feet away from the outfield fence and you couldn't see anything.
There's no question. I mean, I always say, I remember we drew 4 million people here. I think the first year we drew 4 million people here was our second year here. We opened 89. At the Rogers Center, which was the Sky Dome then. You know, I think it was 90 that we did 4 million. It was 91. But in our last year at Exhibition Stadium, which was, you know, base or in 1987, we drew 2.7 million people.
Yeah.
You got people in the bleachers that can't see.
Can't see a thing.
They can't see a thing. Got people on the right field, can't see a thing. And we do, I say, that was what you call a good attendance figure.
Yeah, and not to mention that the phrase luxury boxes was never uttered at Exhibition
Stadium. No.
All right, tell me about between when you get hired in April 7, 77, how much of a challenge was it getting ready to start a baseball franchise the next April?
Well, the best part about it was at that point, you know, I had really been part of hiring what amounted to be my boss, which was Peter Bavese. You know, and so, you know, we put together an organization. Like, I was the first person. We had a woman by the name of Millie Tankrader. We were in Goodman and Goodman. You know, it's now referred to as Goodman's. But, you know, what was Goodman, that was where our office was. It was in the Richmond Adelaide Center. They had a floor. We had an office there. We were in there for 2 months before we really got situated and got down to the C&E. So, I mean, it was all putting everything together, but it was hiring the people, you know. And it wasn't just the baseball people. You know, had to get a ticket manager. You know, we brought in George Holm. You had to get a stadium manager, operations guy. Brought in Terry Barthelmess. You get, you know, Pete putting together everything else. So it was putting the organization. But at the end of it, there was 28 guys. And then you had the draft. And then, you know, the draft happens. And, you know, what do you end up at that point in time? You end up a draft with a total salaries of $810,000. I mean, you know, almost the major league minimum right now. And so the whole thing came in. That's why I say it was a little bit more of a sport, but made two key hires. I mean, we got, you know, when Gillick came in and he brought in Al Amaki and Bobby Maddock, okay? Yeah. And they were kind of the keys because, you know, they'd been around. They were looking to move. They came here. You know, they had the fun of putting it together, and neither of them had that kind of ego that they had to push it. So it was terrific. And I was fortunate because I'm a little guy from Welland, Ontario, who spent, you know, 12 years in London, Ontario, came to Toronto. You know, my father grew up here. You know, he left here at age 31. I moved here at age 31. But I think at the very end of the day, I had the good fortune, everything had to come across my desk. Everything was by hand then. You know, it wasn't computers. You don't see the handwritten checks, you know, like, you know, or if they were, you were, you were really important, someone like you, we would have typed that one out. But, you know, the rest of the handwritten checks, you know, and the ledgers and all that. So you learned the game. You learned what a PDC was. You learned what a minor league contract was. You learned what the signing bonus were. You learn how you pay an agency, you know, how the tickets go and all that stuff. So it was terrific, Dan.
How exciting was it? I mean, you're an expansion team back when expansion teams really were expansion teams, where there was no chance you were going to win early. 77, 78, 79, you start making progress. 81, 82, here come some good young players. 83, you get over 500. 84, you have a great team, but the Tigers are off in another world. And then 85, you win the division. That, for me, and maybe it's because of the age I was, that kind of 83 to 85 period may always be my favorite period, even though they went on to win the World Series in 92 and 93. What were those years like in the 80s as the team was becoming a contender?
Spectacular. I mean, that was the fun part. You're 100% right. We weren't expected to win early. I mean, and we had drafted on a different basis. We took double-A players like Jim Clancy and, you know, Garth Orange and Ernie Witt, guys that, you know, that, you know, might have had most a few games at the major league level, but were basically double-A, but, you know, projected well. I mean, that was the whole deal, and we knew we weren't going to win early. And so, you know, that team came together, and it got better. We had lucky in our draft, you know, when we ended up with getting Steve and then Mosby and Barfield. It was very funny because I was doing my texture the weekend, and Jesse and Lloyd were here on the weekend, you know, and they're all part of Toronto. They're all part of this whole thing when they did it. Then we put Maddock in there when Roy left, and Maddock was, but his strength was development, you know, and so you give him kids, he's going to work with them. He's going to teach him, you know, and the part of the deal is I'll bring you up, put you in the major league level, but you're going to show up at the visiting ballpark at 1 o'clock in the afternoon because you're going to get instruction of how you, you know, you play the wall or how you hit, how you run the bases, you know, how you take a ball at second base. You can name it. You had to be there. If you're prepared to make that commitment, then he would do it. When he left at the end of 81 and Bobby came in, you just got a different feeling. Coxie had, you know, limited success at Atlanta at that point in time, but, you know, nevertheless was just a terrific person, a terrific person to work with. Then the team got good in 83. You got to remember, that was an unbelievable period for the American League East.
Yes.
I mean, it was Baltimore winning in 83. It was the Tigers winning in 84. We won in 85. Boston, 86. Yankees are always Yankees, and I think in about 81 or 82, they might have been the World Series both those times, too. And so you end up with, like, we are in the best division in baseball. Everyone was good, so we had to get good. That's why I always like being in that business.
Well, even Milwaukee was in the American League then, in the American
Absolutely
League East,
right.
And that's Yount and Molitor and Gantner.
That's 100% right.
They were great,
that.
Too.
So. I forgot about that. That was the 82, I think.
Yes, 82. They won the American 82. League and lost
yep.
the World Series. 80, you're right. It was a different team every year, and you guys had to compete with it. You mentioned some of the outfielders. That Bell, Mosby, Barfield, to me, is always one of the best memories that I'll have from that period with the Blue Jays, too. Just a great outfield of three terrifically talented young players all at the same time.
Three talented young players, all with different personalities. I mean, you know, you be with Lloyd and, you know, it just, you know, brings you up. I mean, this man has not got a negative thought in his world. Then you've got this gentle giant in Jesse. I mean, he had a rocket for his arm. You know, like he could hit home runs. I mean, he led the American League in home runs. But, you know, then we had George. Okay.
I knew you'd save him for last.
Then we had George. You mean there was no one like George, okay? They can say what they want, you know. If George was with you, he was with you. I mean, he was one of those guys where, you know, perhaps the rest of the league hated him. There was no one on his team that hated him. I mean, I look at it with this guy, Marchand. You know, like, we all hate Marchand right now until he plays for Canada. Then he's ours.
Right.
And that's the way you play the game. And that is exactly the way you play the game. It's played tough. And if you don't play tough, forget it. Plays for Boston. Now we got to play in just a minute. We got a problem.
You're
but
exactly
that was
right.
That was George, too. That was George. And, you know, George had a tremendous amount of pride. But, you know, the other part he did. He had one weakness, and that is he would play hurt if he was hurt. He felt, you know, like he would never wanted to get out of there. I mean, he just wanted to play the game. But you look at his record when he first started, I mean, he was fast.
Yeah.
Okay? He had, I think, 100 and some stolen bases in the major leagues. You know, Shaker was fast. And then, of course, Jesse, you know, hit the power, but, you know, wasn't slow either. And they were just fun guys, and they caught everybody by surprise. So, 1985, here come the Blue Jays.
Doyle Alexander is an out of way from tying his high as a Blue Jay with 17 wins. He is one out away from pitching the championship game here for the Eastern Division crown. And he's going to go all the way to do it. He works to Hasse. There's a swing and a fly ball left field. Bell is there. He's got it. The Blue Jays have done it. They have won the East. They have won the East. George Bell catching the ball and dropping to his knees. A mob scene out around second base as Doyle Alexander is mobbed by his teammates. Here come the outfielders in. They will be met by their mates and this mammoth crowd that has come streaming down out of the seats now. And the Blue Jays and Doyle Alexander are going to be ushered off the field by their adoring public. Alexander with his cap off, being carried by the throng down there on the field as they make their way toward the Blue Jays dugout. The Blue Jays have defeated the New York Yankees 5-1 and won the Eastern Division Championship. The first ever in the history of the franchise, born just 9 short years ago.
1985, here come the Blue Jays. And then it all ended up beating the Yankees at the end, Dan. That's the one that you probably don't forget, because I still remember knowing that we made it at that point in time, because I was coming back from Ontario Place. It said on the marquee, Yankees versus Blue Jays, 1 o'clock, okay? Yankees, it wasn't, you know, the New York Yankees versus, the, you know, the Toronto Blue Jays, or New York versus Toronto. Yankees versus Blue Jays. And then the city went crazy. And then we should have won, but it was 4-7, and we went 3-1.
How important was your relationship with Pat Gillick to the success of the franchise?
Well, it was very important from the point of view of what he taught me. I mean, you know, like one of the good things about him, I mean, you know, he had the philosophy. I mean, you know, and we had the ownership that had the patience. I mean, you need those two things. One thing to have a philosophy, it's a totally different situation to be able to implement that philosophy. And we had an ownership that was allowing him to go with these double-A players, allowing us to win 54 games our first year, 51 games our second year, 50, and not questioning what he was doing or what the end result might be, or that he was going to lose his job, or that any of us were going to get moved. There was none of that stuff, Dan. I mean, none, zero. I mean, there was the support. What can we do better? And, you know, if we need more money for the Dominican, let's put more money in the Dominican. But then he brought in, you know, the Bob Engels and Moose Johnsons, and we got in all those guys. So the scouting and the development thing came together. We moved Maddock down to development. That whole thing came together.
The Blue Jays' greatest gain has come from their farm system, which has continually provided Toronto with its principal source of talent and given creator Pat Gillick just what he needs to carry out his master plan.
We're always trying to project who we have in the organization, what our needs are, how we're going to fulfill those needs, and how we're going to do this not only on a short range but a long range basis. But I like to think 4 and 5 years down the road, and that's why, in my particular case, I spent a lot of time in the minor leagues looking at the players that we have at the Class A and the rookie level, and hopefully project those players to where they'll be 4 and 5 years from now.
For me and Pat, I mean, it was simple, you know, like, I mean, he was the brains. I'd just go and talk. When we go negotiate, he'd say, that's what we're going to do. And then, you know, we went there. I still remember the first time I went after Bavese left. We went into Cincinnati, and we were negotiating Barry Bonnell. We're sitting there, and the agent's name was Steve Compt. And I figured, I'm going to be with a great Pat Gillick here. I'm going to find out exactly how you negotiate. You know, this is going to be good. Together, okay, Beast, give me our offer. You know, like I didn't know what to say. Like, I didn't know what to say. I mean, but, you know, I eventually got it out because I'm not shy.
Right.
I eventually got it out. And then from there on in, it went for that. But it was he who put together the philosophy. But it was the execution. But you know what? Dad, I've watched this in sports. I've watched it, you know, in every sport, every league, everywhere you want to challenge it or see it. But, you know, if you don't have good ownership, it starts at the top. It starts right at the top. Ownership will take the brunt. Ownership will get the blame. Ownership will, you never say anything good about them. They all say anything bad about them. But if you don't have good ownership, it doesn't work.
So when Pat would come to you and say, we can sign Jack Morris or we can trade for David Cone, then you would go to Labatt and say, here's what Pat wants to do. Is this work for you guys?
The answer to that is yes, except that it was in our budget already. I mean, it was, you know, it was the same thing with, you know, I mean, you give Rogers credit when we traded for Troy Tulowitzki. You know, we were picking up 5 years, $100 million, okay? And so we were getting rid of $20 million in the contract with Reyes. So, but we're picking up three. So you have to basically go to your owner. And, you know, I had already talked to him about it because that had been talked about and then on again, off again. So it was off again. They did. But, you know, when it came to getting David Price, we had room in our budget, okay? And it was 1 year, and so we weren't taking any obligation. So I could say to Alex, you know, Alex, yeah, that's fine. You know, and you can get David Price. Like, let's get a plane and bring him back here. We've got that much money, too. And it all worked out well. So, but you need that, and you need to work with the owner. So, you know, that was it with Pat. I mean, you know, like, people forget, but back in 1992-93, we were the first and the second highest paid salaries in baseball. I mean, like, there was no pullback. Now,
when, as you said,
had some of those
fans.
Guys. You think about the guys we had, though, that played in those teams. Forget, Ricky Henderson was here. I mean, think about this one. Molitor was here. Robbie Alomar was here.
Winfield
was here. Jack Morris, who's just going in the Hall of Fame, was here.
You just named five Hall of Famers.
Hall of Fame. I mean, think about that one. I mean, it was just terrific and a lot of fun. But you know what? You're 100% right. You go back to that early 80s. I'll tell you what, that was a fun time.
Fun.
And the worst part of it, the worst loss of them all were 87.
Yes.
You want to take it any step further, because that's where we should have won.
Yeah. But we want to look at the glasses half full. We're going to talk about the fun stuff. So I'm talking to David Cohen a while back, and I talked to him about coming in 92, and he started game 6 in Atlanta.
Yes, he did.
6 good innings, and then he's out of the game. And I said, so where were you at the moment, Timlin to Carter, and the Blue Jays win the World Series?
Yeah, I was back and forth. I was actually sitting in the clubhouse with Paul Beeston at that moment. We both had a beer in our hands, and we both were nervous as all get out.
That's exactly right.
I said, you weren't back in the dugout? He goes, no, Beeston and I were up in the clubhouse having a beer. That's what you were doing when the Blue Jays won the World
That's
Series?
That's where I was on that first one, yep, in Atlanta. There's no question about it. You like to be with your people, like, I mean, and Coney was terrific. I mean, the little bit that he was here, and then obviously he came back in, I think, 95.
Yes.
But, I mean, he was just a terrific guy. He came with the right attitude. He came with the right determination. He came with the right focus on winning. He did everything else. So I would just happen to go down there because the box was getting kind of full. And people weren't watching. We didn't watch it down there either, quite frankly.
Right.
I mean, we kind of watched it on television. But, I had a couple of beers. That's very kind of him to say one beer. But I can say this about David Cohen because he can say about me, neither of us fed just one beer.
You enjoyed the moment thoroughly on a number of levels.
Exactly right. And it was terrific. It was a fun group of guys. I mean, it was a fun group of guys that came together, Dan. And, we were very fortunate all to be part of it. There was a bond that developed on that team, right? And it ended when the strike came in 94. It ended at that point in time. But the people that were on that team, much like, like the Shakers and the guys in the early days, but that group gets together, and, the word family is overused. I don't want to use that, but everyone does think of themselves as being together and being part of something that was quite special.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. I leave with a little queasiness. I leave with a little bit of trepidation, but I leave with confidence.
Paul Beeston has assumed a new presidency. He is stepping down as president of the Blue Jays into a newly created post, president of Major League Baseball, based in New York.
Well, it is a little bit different and a little bit foreboding in a lot of ways. But, it's been a long climb, I suppose, to the position that I'm in right now. I'm honored that I even had the position with the Blue Jays.
Beeston was the first employee hired by the Blue Jays and brought a business acumen to baseball many consider the most respected in the game. In tandem with GM Pat Gillick, Beeston built the fledgling franchise into a perennial and profitable baseball power.
Later in the 90s, you leave the Blue Jays, you go to New York, you become the president of Major League Baseball. You were there, I think, 5 years. How close do you think you ever became to becoming the commissioner of baseball? There was a lot of talk. You were next. In your mind, was it ever close?
No. Not my. And I didn't want to do it. I went there for 3 years. So I was ready to move from here. Pat had left. The team was sold. It didn't make any sense, Dan, for me to stick around here because if they sold the team, whoever they sold it to was going to be my job. And I wasn't bitter about it.
Yeah.
It only made sense. I said, let's get on with it. Let's get it sold. We'll get this team sold. Whoever buys it can move in here. I'll stick around for a while, then I'll move on somewhere. I don't know where it's going to be. Well, I went on for a year. Then went on for 2 years. And then Selig, was very comfortable in his job and asked me whether or not I would stay. And Bud and I had an unbelievable, fantastic relationship with him for the 5 years we worked together. Okay? Up until that, we are best friends. And now we're best of friends. But, the fact of the matter is I went to New York because Bud asked me to go there. I said I was only going for 3 years. I stayed for five. I had absolutely no aspiration to be commissioner because my style is different than a commissioner. I marveled at Rob coming in here. Rob was the guy I hired. He was working for a law firm in Washington. And there was a suggestion to hire someone else. I said, no, I don't want to do that one. I think Manfred is the guy that can take care of what we used to call the PRC back then, Player Relations Committee. And, put him in charge. And he came in there. And that was in 1997. And so Rob came in. And I watched him last night. I mean, he looks like a commissioner. He acts like a commissioner. He's changed to the sense that, you know, like, he won't say the silly things that I might say, and that he's always available. And I think he's doing an unbelievable job. And I'm very sincere when I say it. I'm very, you know, quite proud of the fact that, you know, that I can, A, call him a friend, but more importantly, Marvel watching his growth. That wasn't me. That wasn't me. Like, I would rather be with the boys in the saloon drinking, you know, but they're not going to beat me up in the morning. I'm going to work at 6 o'clock. They're not going to be there at six.
Right.
Okay? And so, like, I could always get my work in, and then I got some time, and then I go to the game and all that. And because you know all these guys, okay, I got very close to the television guys, the guys from Fox, the guys from NBC, like Ebersole and Shanzer, and, you know, David Hill and Eddie Gorin, and then George Bodenheimer became a good friend. Like, so the ESPN guys became friends. And that was the fun stuff with the sponsors and all that. That was what I did. That's the commissioner's guy. Got to look commissioner, okay? Got to look like a got to look and act like a commissioner. But you know what? I could always be good support for him. So yeah. There was. I'd read this stuff and I'd say, they don't know. The only thing is, I can't A, do it, but B, important than that, I don't want to do it.
One of my favorite moments, not to make this about me, but you would call me every couple of years, and you would say, "Aren't you tired of standing in the customs line at the airport?
Exactly right.
Come on home, Danny." And I came down here a couple of times, and we would sit in this office. The last speeding ticket I got was coming down here because I was late, and I didn't want to be late for you. And you were always wonderful to me, and you always said, "Come on back home. Come on back home." So it took me a little while to listen to you, but it's fun to be back. And I'm sure you feel this too. When you came back the second time, home is home. You can go home again, and you came back here the second time. Different ownership, as you said, different situation. But are you glad you always decided to come back to Toronto and rejoin the Blue Jays and have a second tenure with this organization?
Yeah, I was, again, you know, someone's looking after me up top. I mean, you know, there's no question that there is some angel up there that has, you know, got me under their, has been assigned to me, you know, because when I came back.
Sounds like a full-time job.
Yeah, so, yeah. You're right. But back when I came back in 19, man, I was only staying for a year. And then, you know, what happened was we made some changes, got things moving. And I took it. I was supposed to be finding a president. And I brought three, what I didn't think qualified people. I think really qualified people. Like, I mean, fantastically qualified people. And for one reason, didn't work out. And the other two, they weren't kind of accepted at that point. So, but then all of a sudden, you know, made a decision to replace JP. And, you know, Alex went in and, you know, this could be fun for 3 or 4 years, you know, because he's young, he's fun, he's aggressive. I mean, you know, we had the good group there. You know, we were going to restructure the whole place. We'd restructured the way we do ticketing. We'd restructured the way we did everything. We tried to get you back. You again said no. I mean, you stayed consistent. I'm going to do my basketball. I'm going to do my ESPN. I'm going to do all that. Forget that shit. You know, but the reality is, you know, it got to be fun. And I'll tell you what, those were great years. And you know what? As I got older, and I was working with younger people, it was a lot more fun. It was a lot more fun, Danny. I mean, you know, like, I mean, I became the Mr. Hardy and the Bobby Maddock and everyone like that, you know? More probably than Bobby Maddock than anyone else, because we had a few of the same qualities. not baseball-wise, but a few of the other qualities. But, you know, the reality story was it was a terrific, terrific time, and I had great relationships with with Tony Viner and Nadir Muhammad, so I could always, you know, make my access to him. And it worked, and then the things started to come, you know? And then, you know, I really thought in 2013 we had a great team. I thought when we got Reyes and Bonifacio was going to be the guy that we stole, and Johnson, you know, like, and Burley. But we and them getting Dickey and getting, you know, everything came down. But, you know, it all happens for a reason. And while we didn't do well in 2014, you know, by the time 2015 everything came along, we were on our way. And we knew that there was a following, you know, and it was just fun to be part of. It was just terrific.
A whole new generation, like my son's age, a whole new generation of people who had grown up listening to nothing but stories of 92 and 93 finally had a chance to have their own stories.
Exactly, yeah. Right, and they should have their own stories. I mean, who wants to, like, I got tired myself of listening about the past. I mean, you know, I really did. I mean, we're talking 92, 93, we're talking 20 years ago, okay? It's time to create your own book. That book is finished. Put it on the shelf, okay? Look at it, you know, because, you know, it was a classic. You know, it was good Dickens stuff, you know? Yeah. I don't think it was Shakespeare. But, you know, the reality is I really do believe that's right. I do believe that, you know, people, your son, my grandchildren, they don't relate. I mean, guys like Mosby, you know, or guys like, we can go right back to, I mean, God, I'd like to meet Doyle Alexander and all those, you know, but you go back to these guys. I mean, you know, they're old-timers, okay? Yeah. the guys they got right now they can identify with and they'll grow up with and they'll keep the memories of them for the years to come.
Yeah.
Like Jose. I mean, you know, think what Jose did. I mean, Jose had a hell of a career here. Like a hell
they'll
of
They'll have a day
career.
For him here.
So did
point.
Eddie.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Eddie had a hell of a career. Doc, you know, those are the guys. I mean, you know, we didn't have success as a team until, you know, 2015. You know, and that was really for effectively 3 months. Alex doesn't like me. Remember this. You know, we were 50-51, yeah. Alex. I mean, let's be realistic about it.
Better to
this.
Have the 3 months be at the end of the season.
Oh, no question. At the beginning, so. No question.
All right, let me dust off the old book for one question I should have asked you earlier. 1983, I believe, is the year Dave Winfield is playing center field for the Yankees at Exhibition Stadium. And maybe accidentally, maybe not accidentally, kills a seagull throwing the ball back in between innings warm-up. The Yankees are due to fly out of town after the game. Dave Winfield is arrested after the game by a constable who is on duty at Exhibition Stadium, and he is told he has to go down to the station and I believe is formally charged with cruelty to animals, which charges are dropped the next morning, I think. From my understanding, you and Pat Gillick both went with Dave Winfield down to the station. What was that night like? And part two, did that night lay the foundation, the relationship that some people say, that's why Winfield ended up signing here, because he developed a relationship, whether it was you, Pat, or both. He appreciated what you did for him that night, and that laid the foundation for Winfield becoming a Blue Jay in 92.
Well, he certainly remembered it. I mean, there were, you know, when we got into the discussions and everything, I mean, he certainly remembered all that. I mean, no, I think that it was the only thing that we could have done. I mean, you know, he was there. I mean, he didn't try to hit that bird. I'm convinced of that. You know, like, I mean, they try, but they expect to. Maybe I shouldn't say that. I mean, you know, as much as those birds or seagulls gave us trouble, we didn't want to see anybody hit one because it is cruel. He had tried it. As Billy Martin said, the first time he hit the cutoff man all year. Okay, but, you know, we went down with him because, you know, we had the relationship with what was then Metro PD. You know, we want to explain to him what happened, why it happened. You know, he had been charged. So all we did was offer the support we could offer. It was a kind of a, in some respects, a Yankee problem because he was Yankees. You know, he was a Yankee player.
Right.
And so, but he got out that night.
But
they had rolled the plane, so it would have been a lot of happy people.
Right. But years later, when you sat down to talk to him,
we went through all that. But I mean, like, I mean, this guy wouldn't hurt anybody as big as he is. Yeah. I mean, and you know, I mean, the only time that he would ever hurt anybody is when he was in that basketball game in Minnesota. I mean, you know, that was extended. But no, Dan, and the fact of the matter is, I mean, he liked Toronto. I think liked the way that we handled that one. But by then, you know, Toronto was really exploding. And remember one other thing. We had a pretty damn good team.
Yes.
Okay? And most of those guys, like, if he'd been looking for a job and we were in last place, they would say, Toronto's a nice place to visit. We can go in there twice a year. We were a pretty good team in 91. Yes. You know, we had Alomar, and we got, at that point, Joe Carter. We got Devo in center field. The pitching's now starting to come along with Guzman and all. And it was a pretty good team. So for him to come here was you know, an opportunity to win, too, because he had never won. You think
yes,
of that
that's right. Same with Molitor, who came in 93, another guy who had never won. I don't know if you can answer this one. Favorite all-time player. Favorite player that you are happiest you had in the organization at some point.
Well, it's very difficult to answer that question. I can answer it, but, I mean, you know, the easiest thing for me to just say is George, okay? But, you know, that's not, you know, like, I mean, but that does disservice to so many good people that I was able to be associated with or that we were able to have in our organization. You know, ball players are terrific guys, and my relationship with George was special, and it will be my relationship with Robbie is special, and I always will be, but I can go back with Devo. I can go back with, you know, a lot of these guys. The newer group, not so much, Dan. After I left here, but before that, Paul Molitor was a good friend. Eddie Sprague, you can go through them all. The Shaker and I pick up as if we were together yesterday. I mean, but there was a bond, and I was down in the Dominican this year, and, you know, we spent some time with George when we were there and everything. There is this relationship that is quite special.
And other than getting hounded to do podcasts by people like me, how do you keep busy these days? You're president emeritus now with the club. We're sitting in your office at the ballpark. How do you stay
And busy? You know what that means. All that means is that you've got all the answers, none of the accountability. You know,
sounds perfect.
It's the greatest thing in the world. Dan. No, I sit a few corporate boards. I still sit in the Baseball Hall of Fame board at Cooperstown, which keeps me there. And you know what? Go to the games. I'm telling you, I've been lucky. I mean, it's been a lot of fun. But you know what? Somehow, only thing that you find out when you don't have a job, and I always like say I'm unemployed. because, you know, that'll end the conversation right there. If you tell people that you're a consultant, you know, what are you consulting? You're retired. You got too much energy. You're too young to retire. You tell me you're unemployed. That's the end of the conversation. But you know what? I've been fortunate being able to do what I'm doing. And quite honestly, I have absolutely much to be thankful and very, very few regrets on anything that happened in my life.
Well, that's great. Not many people can say that. And as lucky as you feel you've been is as lucky as this city and this fan base has been and was to have you running the organization, because I don't think there are two banners hanging up there if you're not the president.
Oh, I don't think that's true, because there's 25 guys you put out there that are responsible. There's 20, and when people forget that, okay, I always tell Alex this all the time. I told Gillick a few times too, you know, we can sell tickets to watch you make trades. Then we got a business, okay? Right. We got 25 guys that drive the entire. So let's give the right 25. Let's bring the money, and we can all get paid better.
Worked out okay. It's a good story.
It's a good one.
Worked out okay. Really appreciate it.
Danny, all the best.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
A guy who, as you can tell just from listening to him, is incredibly personable. I mean, when he's in a room, you know Paul Beeston's in a room. And those skills that he had, a huge, huge part of why the Blue Jays were such a successful organization when Beeston was the president. When we come back, again, rapid-fire questions with Luke Maley. I asked him all kinds of things I did not know about being a major league catcher, and I told him the only answer you got to give is what comes to your mind right away. That's what we're looking for when we come back with Luke Maley.
Sportsnet returns as the exclusive home of everything Blue Jays. Get breaking news and reaction as it happens.
How about that?
From the clubhouse to the dugout and on the field. All access, all the time.
Swing and a drive, deep to right.
A no-quit team, off and on the field. Canada's deepest roster of baseball experts. Only on Sportsnet, the exclusive home of everything Blue Jays.
The 0-1, and a swing and a base hit into right field. Here comes Millar, and Luke Maley has won it for the Blue Jays. What a night for Maley. Two hits, three runs driven in, and the Blue Jays sweep the doubleheader. All right, Luke, you're my guinea pig for this. Quick questions, quick answers. The only incorrect answer is anything other than your first answer. Whatever comes to mind is all we're looking for. I assume, like most kids, you played a lot of different positions growing up. Why and when did you decide to become a catcher?
I had a coach tell me pretty early on that it was going to be a little bit easier for me to, you know, play at a higher level if I caught, because I swung the bat pretty good and I had a pretty good arm. So I moved from shortstop and stopped pitching for the most part when I was about 10 or 11, and the rest is history, I guess.
What body part is sore the most often for a big league catcher?
Probably my wrist from foul tips and that.
What do you remember about your first big league home run?
I remember not expecting to hit one. I was just trying to stay the other way and get a little base hit, but just happened to catch it a little out in front, and it went a long way, man. I kind of surprised myself.
Who was it off of?
A.J. Griffin.
Signed by the Oakland A's. There's a shot to left field. That baby's going to get out of here. Home run for Luke Maley. Maley gives the Rays a 2-0 lead and picks up his first home run. That's his first big league home run. And there wasn't much doubt from the time it left the bat.
Yeah, that's that slider, a little cutter. That one didn't have a lot of movement. It just kind of was rolling in there, and Luke Maley was all over it.
Back in the day, whatever catcher who wasn't in the lineup would be down in the bullpen warming up relief pitchers during the game. And then if you had to pinch hit or come in, you'd jog in from the bullpen. Can you imagine doing that these days?
It wasn't too long ago where I was doing that in the minor leagues. But, yeah, it's kind of ridiculous to think about it now, especially where they have some of these bullpens in major league ballparks. It feels like they're, you know, in the parking lot next door. But thank God for bullpen catchers these days, man.
Funniest conversation you've ever had with a pitcher on the mound?
Oh, I've got a lot of them. I'd have to probably say Blake Snell back in AAA. I'm not even sure. It's not that I can't repeat it because it was dirty. I can't repeat it because it was a little out there. But he's a good dude. He's one of my buddies.
When there's a cross-up between a pitcher and a catcher, what percentage of the time is the pitcher wrong?
Upwards of 95%, I would say, somewhere in there.
And if I ask a pitcher that question, what are they going to say?
They might say something different. I have screwed up, though. I have screwed up recently, too, but it doesn't happen too often.
Okay, finish this sentence. My opinion of social media is?
I don't have one because I don't have any.
And why is that? Why is that your game plan?
Because I don't think I could figure out exactly how to accumulate followers or who to follow. I don't know. I got enough stuff going on, so I just kind of stick with that.
It is a simpler existence not to have it. Last one. If you weren't a baseball player, what would you be doing?
I'd like to think I'd be playing golf somewhat competitively, but that might be a bit of a stretch. But who knows, man? I mean, I think if I wasn't a baseball player, I'd probably be a baseball coach, honestly.
All right. Thanks for doing this. We appreciate the time.
No problem.
First pitch to Mailey. Swung on, hit in the air, and a gap in right center field. That's hit deep. That is up, and that is gone! Lukey Barrels walks it off with a two-run homer, and he is mobbed by his teammates at home plate. No home runs this season heading into this game, and two tonight. One to tie it in the seventh, one to win it in the 12th. The Blue Jays take down the Red Sox by a score of 5-3.
Well, I think Luke did pretty well. Put some pressure on him, and I think like a true big leaguer, he was up to the task. We're going to do this from time to time, rapid-fire questions with players, just to see what their first answers are to whatever it is they're hearing from me. Now, as listeners to A Swing and a Belt know, one of my favorite parts of this is talking to broadcasters from around the sport, whether it's national or local. And one of the very best in the game, Hall of Famer Eric Nadell, has been calling Texas Rangers games for 40 years. Had a chance to catch up with Eric and talk to him about his time in the big leagues and a really interesting Toronto Maple Leaf connection that helped get him his start in baseball.
Harry to the set, now to the plate. Cruz is swinging, a high fly down the left field line. It is hooking deep in the corner. Way back, that ball is history. A walk-off grand slam for Nelson Cruz. The ballpark is exploding. Cruz fires his helmet, arrives at home plate. The Rangers are there waiting. They have beaten the Tigers 7-3.
Eric, you've been the broadcaster for the Texas Rangers for 40 years. I was going to guess in the mid-30s. I didn't realize it was 40. Congratulations on that. Do you think back to year one, could you ever have imagined you'd be doing it for 40 years?
I was just trying to make it through the first year. You know, I was a hockey announcer who had never broadcast a baseball game, and I was literally learning on the job, and fortunately they were patient enough to let me do that.
So if you hadn't done any baseball before, how'd you wind up getting a major league job 40 years ago?
I was in Dallas as the AAA hockey announcer for the Maple Leafs and the Chicago Blackhawks, who shared the Dallas Blackhawks at that time. We had Bruce Boudreau was on that team, Randy Carlyle, Jim McKenney, a lot of great Leaf names. And I got a call from the Texas Rangers one day, right about the time that the Leafs decided they were moving their farm club to Moncton, New Brunswick, where they couldn't take me. They couldn't take an American hockey announcer up there. And just as luck have it, the Rangers were looking for a young announcer that they could train. And I was in the market. They didn't have to pay moving expenses. I had played baseball until college and listened to a million games growing up in New York. And they let me audition. I did four games into a tape recorder. They hired me in August to start the following March, and I had a whole off season to kind of study and get ready.
That's a great story. I also got my first baseball job here because I was young, local, and cheap. So sometimes, you know, you look at it as a negative, but it can actually turn into a positive. So 40 years, over 6,000 games. How has it changed for you over 40 years? Do you still enjoy it as much as year one? How has it evolved for you?
I can't say I enjoy the game itself as much as I used to, because partially maybe I'm a little burnt out, and maybe it's just the nature of the game, because the ball isn't in play as much with all the emphasis on home runs and walks, and nobody cares about strikeouts. I really don't like that. And the game's much longer. It's over a half an hour longer than when I started. Pitchers take more time. Relievers pitch more of the innings, and they take more time than the starters. So the rhythm of the game has changed, and my job's actually gotten a lot harder. I mean, it's a half hour of dead time that we're basically killing in the booth. So I wouldn't say I like it as much, but it still beats working. It's still fun to come to the ballpark.
Well, tell me, because people ask me this, give me your game day routine. It's a 7 o'clock game, home or away, whatever you choose. Give me your routine getting ready for a ball game that night.
Well, now I come in at about 3, because our manager, Jeff Bannister, likes to be done with the media by 4, and I'm usually the first guy who gets in there. I have to be ready to get in there by 3:15. Sometimes I don't get until 3:30 or 3:45. Once I'm done with him at about 4 o'clock, I've basically got 3 hours to prepare for the game. I now do it all there. I used to do work at home. I don't do that anymore. I've got enough time at the ballpark in those 3 hours to talk to the people I want to talk to, read the stuff I want to read, look up the stuff I want to look up, get the scorebook ready, you know, and grab a little bit to eat. So on a normal day, I mean, I go to sleep at 1 in the morning usually. I wake about 9. You know, I'll get a workout in, have lunch with my wife usually, a little bit of busy work in the early afternoon, and head for the ballpark about 2:15.
If somebody picked up your scorebook, how much of it would be stuff they couldn't read? How much of it is Eric Nadel shorthand that only can be read by you?
It's not that it's shorthand. It's just illegible. I have doctor's penmanship. 90% would be illegible to most people, I think.
But can you look back on it a month later and you can still understand everything that's on there?
Most of the time. Most of the time. Sometimes I'm getting so bad now, sometimes I can't even read my own writing.
One of my favorite things about you and your career is that you really took it upon yourself to learn Spanish as well as you could, to the point where I believe you were able to, you went on the Spanish language broadcast, you would do some broadcasting in Spanish. How did that come about, and how challenging? It makes you respect what the Latino players do, having to learn English to speak to us when we want to interview them. What was that process like for you?
It was really hard. I didn't start learning Spanish till I was 40. When Ruben Sierra first came to the big leagues with the Rangers in the late 80s, he was immediately our best player, and nobody could talk to him without a translator. That's when I was determined to start learning Spanish. We knew we had Pudge Rodriguez, Juan Gonzalez on the way. Rangers had a Latin American pipeline then. So I started taking lessons, and after a couple of years, I was brave enough to start going to Latin America and have total immersion experiences. And it's still a battle. I try to speak Spanish every day, at least for a while. I email with friends of mine in Cuba and a couple of other countries to try and stay fresh, to try and always improve. It really helps me, though, when these players come here, if they can't speak English and I can speak to them in Spanish, it engenders trust that is beyond anything you could have in any other way. Plus the fact I've been to their countries now. I've been to all the countries where they play baseball, and I can talk to them about that, too.
That's terrific. I'm sure that goes a long way with the ballplayers. Last thing for you, 2014, you were Baseball Hall of Fame's honoree, the Ford Frick Award for Baseball Broadcasting Excellence. When you look at the other names on the list, it must have been a great moment for you, obviously, professionally. What was it like being in Cooperstown in 2014 to receive that award?
It wasn't. And still is surreal, Dan. I really felt that weekend staying in the Otisaga Hotel with only Hall of Famers like I had sneaked into some private club and got away with it. It was incredible. I go to the maid's cart, and, you know, there's Ernie Banks taking towels off the maid's cart and Whitey Ford's at the Coke machine. It was like I'm in some crazy dream or something. But for me, having grown up in New York, idolizing Mel Allen and Red Barber, and then Lindsey Nelson and Bob Murphy, and to be on the same wall with those people, not to mention Ernie Harwell and Jack Buck and, you know, the other greats of the business, I really appreciate it. It's an incredible honor. It still somehow doesn't feel right. It's like there should be a different category for Vin Scully and those guys, and then for us younger guys. They really paved the way in this.
Well, it's a great honor, and Rich, if you won't say it about yourself, I'll say it about you. You belong there. So congratulations, and thanks for joining me this week. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And that'll do it for another installment of A Swing and a Belt. Again, thanks as always to Emil Delich, our outstanding producer. Ben was off this week. We're going to put him to work again next week. For next week's episode, you can reach us with a hashtag, A Swing and a Belt, or on Twitter, you can tweet me at @DShulman_ESPN or Ben at @BenShulman7. All thoughts are welcome. On next week's installment of A Swing and a Belt, we'll have an in-depth look at the career of the best player in the game and a guy who could become one of the best players in the history of the game if he stays on his current path. Mike Trout of the Los Angeles Angels. Until then, thanks for listening.
Joe has had his moments, trying to lay off that ball low to the outside part of the plate, and he just went after one. 2 balls and 2 strikes on it. Here's a pitch on the way, a swing and a belt. Left field, way back. Blue Jays win it. The Blue Jays are World Series champions as Joe Carter hits a 3-run home run in the 9th inning, and the Blue Jays have repeated as World Series champions. Touch a ball, Joe. You'll never hit a bigger home run in your life.